Anwar, office worker. You smell hot oil and cardamom as you walk through the front door. Hi, Bibi, I'm home. She's in the kitchen. Yes, dear, she calls distractedly. Have you seen Nassim? I sent him round to Uncle Lal's for a bunch of methi, and he's not come back. I think he's playing with his English friends again. In Bibi's world, English is a wild card ethnicity. It could equally mean Scottish or Lithuanian. And he's forgotten, the little scamp. No, haven't seen him. You suppress the urge to grump at her. What am I, his nursemaid? As you close the front door and hang your jacket up. The boy'll be fine. You can locate him on GPS just as soon as you take the sock off your phone. I've been looking for an office. I think I've found one. Oh, good. Hey, come and be a dear and help peel these onions. You know they make me... Cry, you mentally autocomplete, suppressing a snort and heading into the kitchen. It's one of Bibi's stranger foibles. Despite the day job, she insists on cooking, but she can't, absolutely can't, peel and chop onions. You said no and watched her try just the once years ago. The memory of what it did to her eyes is still enough to make you wince. Now she's got a German gadget to chop them up, but getting the outer skin off first is a man's job. Where is that boy? You join Bibi in the kitchen, where she's frying up spices, and take a knife to the offending onions. It's probably her contact lenses. Why can't she just wear spectacles while she's cooking? Your Auntie Samina called round earlier, you know. She was wanting to know all about this mystery job of yours, but I told her it was none of her business until you're good and ready to tell everyone. Trade secrets. That hushed her up, I can tell you. She watches too many trashy spy soaps from Karachi. She thinks you're still secretly a black hat hacker. You wordlessly pass her the bowl of onions. She stuffs them into the German gadget, closes the lid, and stares at you significantly as she puts some serious arm action into the handle. It's a sign that she expects you to read her mind. She's a firm believer in male telepathy, and you've never quite had the nuts to break it to her that she'd do much better at silent communication if she simply stuck to jerking your dick in Morse code. You waggle your eyebrows at her. What is it? She pauses, then looks up at you. What is this mysterious job that you need to rent an office for, oh my husband? She's using this oddly stilted excuse for a private language she picked up from fuck knows where. Some Bollywood musical version of domestic married bliss, perhaps. She's even batting her eyelashes. You may be telepathically deaf, but even you can figure out that this is the feminine equivalent of boldface and double underlined capitals. You lean close, put an arm around her shoulder, and ask her, "Can you keep a secret, oh my wife?" She leans against you, seeking contact, which is nice. For once there are no kids present. "If you ask me to, nicely." You kiss the top of her head. "All right, but please don't tell your mother. She'll get too excited." "It's all to do with that job interview I had last week, the one the gnome sent my way." "I knew it!" She tenses angrily. "That rat!" She doesn't pull away, but you can feel her quiver with indignation, and something inside you locks up tight. Bibi doesn't know your exact relationship with Adam, but he's been around occasionally, and she doesn't like or trust him. She knows he's a business associate, and that's bad enough for her. The kind of business associate whose company landed you in Sochten, she thinks. Nonsense. It was just a spot of bad luck. But needs must, and ruffled feathers need smoothing. "No, love, it's not something I'm doing for him. It's just something he was able to point my way. It's not big, but it's useful, and there's money in it. And more importantly, it'll convince the social workers that I'm getting my life straightened out." "Is it legal?" she asks pointedly. It's more than legal. It's for a government. Well, then. That shuts her up for a moment, but not for two. She's not stupid. What government? The Scottish? No. The current administration is a hive of snake-fondling Christians in league with the Wee Freeze. Luckily, it looks as if they're going to go down hard at the next election. You see, the job interview wasn't in London, and I didn't get the sleeper train. I had to fly all the way to Przewalsk, and I got the job. I'm going to be... You savour the moment as you prepare to tell her. The Honorary Consul in Edinburgh for the Independent Republic of Issyk. Ouch! You were about to say Kulistan when your loving, obedient wife dropped the German gadget on your foot. Oh! She ignores your injury and scrabbles around on the floor in pursuit of the onion compartment, which has taken on a life of its own and is rolling enthusiastically towards the table. You stifle a rude word. Being German, the gadget is over-engineered and surprisingly heavy, and instead bend over and pick up the detachable handle. The plastic collar where it fits onto the onion eviscerator, or whatever it's called, has broken, and there's a smell of burning, worse, of hot metal from the frying pan. Bibi stands up, snorting deeply like an angry heifer, as she clutches a clear plastic tub of finely chopped onions. Her chest rises and falls fetchingly under her blouse as she stares at you in disbelief. Honorary what? You're making shit up again, you worthless sack of... Then she blinks and lunges past you in the direction of the cooker. Oh, my pan! Oh, no! This is a disaster! Right at that moment, the front door opens with a fanfare of brassy pre-teen boys' voices, and everything gets a little vague. You're not sure how the plastic-coloured German onion-destroying gadget's handle ends up in the frying pan, or why the turmeric ends up in the bowl of gram flour and the whole mess ends up on the floor, or where the smell of burning plastic is coming from, because the smoke detector has gone off its little electronic trolley and is screeching loud enough to wake the dead. But you beat a hasty retreat from the self-deconstructing kitchen. Go and help your mother, you sternly tell your son, who's clutching a paper bag and chattering excitedly about something football-related that he and his friend Mo have done. Then you tiptoe away with a sinking heart. Bibi will blame you for setting the kitchen on fire, and she'll make you go chase after a template for the broken part of the German gadget and repair the thing. Why do your attempts to do good for her always seem to end up this way? Your hard work has paid off. In the process of examining commercial properties, you stumbled upon some most remarkably posh digs at a knock-down price for your consular mission. It's in one corner of a modernist glass cube that's embedded like a gestating alien larva within the bowels of the former post office headquarters on North Bridge. The Gothic architraves of Scottish baronial limestone pulse with an eerie green radiance after dusk. Passers-by who peer between the sandstone window casements can see the cleaning robots casting long shadows across the cube's windows as they skitter hither and yon. It's supposedly haunted by the ghost of a Microsoft sales rep who hanged herself in the central atrium a couple of decades ago. Some of the ghost tours from the Royal Mile have taken stopping by late at night. Admittedly, your stipend doesn't stretch to anything particularly plush. Your wee niche in the former Microsoft HQ is a 3-metre-by-4 room in a shared office suite. It's half-filled by a scratched-up pine desk and a pre-owned Aeron chair the management threw in as a sweetener. The rest of the suite is overrun by programmers from a local gaming corporation who rent 2 entire floors above you. They're working on some kind of artificial reality project. You made the fatal mistake of asking one of them, and your eyes glazed over before he reached the fourth paragraph of nerd-speak without stopping to draw breath. But at least you're not hot-desking or hanging out your shingle above Raffi's phone unlocking and discount print shop on Easter Road. No, indeed. You've come up in the world. You have an office of your own. You wear a suit and tie to work, and people respect you. Well, we'll soon see about that. Mr. Webber was certainly taken aback at your last interview.
Representing a consortium of Central Asian commercial interests in the Midlothian region.
He doodled a note on his tablet.
Well, Anwar, you never cease to surprise me. A family connection, I assume.
You grinned and refrained from blabbing, but produced the documentation when he asked to see it. The smug bastard really raised an eyebrow when you showed him the letterhead. He's going to check it out, but the beauty is that it will check out, which means your future sessions with him will be reduced to 30-second ticky boxes rather than real probation interviews. Going straight doesn't get much straighter than wearing a suit and working for a foreign government. Actually, there's fuck all work in it. You've set up your office and your desk just so, and you've skimmed the helpful handbook they've prepared for honorary consuls. The first IBAN draft hits your bank account with a thud, and now you're sitting pretty. Cousin Shani's handling your tax. She's an accountant, and you're in credit and in employment. But after the first few days of scurrying around filling out online forms, it's a bit boring. As the gnome surmised, few natives of Issyk Kulistan pass through Scotland. In fact, it's a lot boring. There isn't even any email to answer. Alas, you've got to be behind the desk during core hours, all 20 of them a week. After a bit, you ask Tariq if you can borrow a pad so you can work on his dating website while you're holding the fort. Nobody who walks in will know it from what you're supposed to be doing, and you can do with the cash. So you're there one mid-afternoon grinding your teeth over a broken style sheet when the doorbell chimes. At first you mistake it for your IDE complaining about a syntax error, but then it rings again, and you see the desk set blinking its light at you. You've got company.
Hello. Consulate of the Independent Republic of Issyk Kulistan?
The desk set clears its throat.
Hello, the consulate. Please to be letting us in.
You stare for a couple of seconds, then figure out which button to push on the antique console. You hear the front door open and hide Tariq's pad before you stand up and go to see who it is. Two men are peering twitchily around the lobby area of the shared offices. One's in his late 20s and the other is considerably older. They've both got close-cropped hair, bushy moustaches, and an indefinable air of perplexity that screams foreigner at you. The younger one is clutching the handle of a gigantic rolling case.
Hello, can I help you?
You ask politely enough, and the young guy nearly jumps out of his skin.
Hello, this is Consulate of Przewalsk.
The younger guy's English is clearly a second language, or third.
Hussein Anwar?
That's me, you say, nodding. Can I ask what your business is, sir? You really want to get back to fixing Tariq's botched style sheet, and you haven't snapped into the right headspace, but it comes out sounding patronizing and officious. The old guy turns to his young companion and rattles something off. The young guy replies, then turns to you.
He says we need to speak in your office. We are visiting trade delegation. Felix Tatka sends us to you.
Oh, well, that puts a different face on things.
Certainly, if you'd like to follow me.
Your office is equipped with 2 plastic visitor's chairs and a regrettably non-plastic rubber plant, which has hideous yellow-rimmed holes in its leaves but refuses to die despite your daily libation of coffee grounds. You usher the trade delegation past the plant and wave them into the seats. "What brings you to Edinburgh?" you ask.
"Emails you have read, the..."
begins the old guy before his young companion takes over.
"My friend here, he is being lead trade mission to sell produce of our factories to foreign markets. There should an email be. We bring here for you a consignment of trade samples to be distributed to visitors."
The old guy nods emphatically.
"You give we."
He waves at the huge and villainous suitcase, which is already settling into the carpet.
"Samples."
Yes, I see. What kind of samples? You watch, fascinated, as the young guy fiddles with the substantial locks on the case. He opens the lid with a flourish, not unlike a magician pulling a rabbit from a hat.
"Look,"
he announces. The suitcase is full of white paper bags. He pulls one out and hands it to you. The label reads, "Insect-free, fair-trade organic bread mix barley rye."
"For Western home bread-maker machine," says the young guy, as the old guy grins broadly and nods. "It's produced by People's Number 4 Grain Products Factory of Uzbekistan. Tastes very good. No grit. Batteries included. Just add water."
"Batteries?" You shake your head.
"Yeast," he says hastily. "You give. Visitors."
You eye up the enormous suitcase. "You want me to give visitors bags of bread mix?" you ask him. "But I don't have room here." The old guy nods again.
"Give he your visitors bread."
He looks at you and suddenly recognizes his expression, and you just about shit yourself.
"Is visitors, yes? Email is..."
"The instructions are for you in the email,"
the young guy adds helpfully. He stands up.
"We go now. Other consuls, more trade."
He grins alarmingly widely and reaches out to shake your hand. His skin is dry and hot, his grip tight as a handcuff.
"I'm thanking you. You are good man," says Conall Datka.
After the trade delegation leaves, you sit behind your desk breathing heavily for a couple of minutes. The suitcase crouches behind the dying rubber plant like a snooping secret policeman intent on exposing your guilt. Who do they think I am? Does Datka think I'm stupid or something? You glare at the case. It's obviously drugs. That's what this is all about. They've figured out how to use diplomatic bags and trade delegations to smuggle heroin out of Abkhazia or Ruritania or somewhere, and now you're expected to play host to an endless revolving door parade of dealers. Well, it won't do. You weren't born yesterday. If they think you're going to tamely take the fall for a mere €1,000 a month... You've got a wife and kids to look after. And you've met Datka. Colonel Datka. Spoken to him. He's not stupid. He's got to know this is shit. Curiosity gets the better of you, and you reach for the white paper bag on the edge of your desk. It weighs about 1 kilogram. You close your eyes, hefting it. The suitcase has got to hold at least 50 more of them, from the way it's digging in the carpet. If this is heroin, it's got to be worth 500,000 on the street. Datka's met you.
Would you leave yourself in possession of 500,000 in heroin, sight unseen? Holy Moses, Jesus and Mohammed, peace be unto him. No, you wouldn't. But Datka knows where you live. He knows where Bibi and Nassim and Farida and everything you hold precious can be found. And you've met plenty of cheerfully ruthless men who wouldn't hesitate to use... Your hands are sweating, and you feel yourself shaking as you tear open the flap of the bag of insect-free, fair-trade organic bread mix barley rye, produce of People's Number 4 Grain Products Factory of Issyk Kulistan, and jam your thumb inside, crush the coarse flour against the paper, raise it to your mouth, and suck. It's just flour. Ingredients: malted barley 40%, rye 30%, wheat 20%, ascorbic acid, fructose glucose concentrate, sodium metabisulfite, sodium chloride, amylase, protease, vegetable fat 3%, raising agent, yeast. Add water, 320 milliliters to 500 grams of bread mix. Place in bread maker and select Whole Meal Rapid Program. Your shuddering gasp of relief is that of a condemned man receiving his pardon on the steps of the gallows. It's no less heartfelt. You lean back in your chair, eyes screwed shut. You've never been much of one for your daily observations, but right now you make a mental note to lay in a prayer rug against the prospect of future roving visits by feral international trade delegations. God is indeed great. He's sent you organic stone-ground bread mix instead of heroin. The only question is, why? And so, at 4 o'clock, you switch on call divert, lock the office behind you, and go in search of the gnome. This afternoon, Adam is holding court in the back of the halfway house, a wee nook alongside Flesh Market Close, an improbably stepped thoroughfare that runs up the arse crack from the City Art Gallery to Coburn Street. You know you're in the old town when the street's so steep they've been talking about fitting an escalator for the tourists. You take a short cut through the upper retail deck of Waverley Station, dodging the commuter crowds, and reach the front door with only a slight shortness of breath. "Ah, Anwar," calls the gnome. "Mine's a pint of 60 bob." Bloody typical.
You sidle up to the bar and smile ingratiatingly until the wee lassie deigns to notice you and pours your pints. Your IPA and the aforementioned sticky black treacle syrup for the gnome. You carry it to the back. The gnome smacks his lips and slides his pad away.
"I didn't think there was any signal down here," you say. "There isn't usually."
The gnome looks pleased with his pint of mild.
"It's in fine form today. Chewy, with a fine malt aftertaste and some interesting hops."
You open your messenger bag, extricate the slightly leaky sack of bread mix, and plop it on the table in front of him. "Would it go with this?" The gnome stares at it for a moment, then picks it up.
"You scanned it," he says tersely. "Where did you get it?"
"No RFIDs," you tell him. "Only the best organic ingredients," said the visiting trade delegation. "I'm to hand them out to visitors, according to Colonel Datka." You chug half your pint in a single panicky, sharp-edged gulp.
"What have you got me into?"
The gnome, for once, is at a loss for words.
"I dinna ken, sonny,"
he says, lapsing into a self-parody of his ancestral Ayrshire accent.
"Sorry. It appears to be bread mix."
He peers at the label.
"Lots of malted barley
I suppose you could use it for home brewing. Some hops, a couple of demijohns. The yeast's probably not ideal. He trails off thoughtfully. Then he looks up at you. It's bread mix, he says crisply. Tell yourself, it's just bread mix. Give it to anyone who stops by. Tell them it's bread mix, if by some chance the police pay you a visit. It's just bread mix. You've got that frozen feeling again. Fucking fuck, are you telling me... The gnome reaches out and grabs your wrist. It's just bread mix, he hisses. He stabs at the bag with one index finger. If you put that in your bread maker, if you've got one, it will make bread. End of story. That's all you need to know. You pull your hand back. No, it isn't. Believe me, he says slowly. You cross your arms, mulish. Tell me, or it's all going down the shitter tonight. He begins to smile. I wouldn't do that. Dough tends to clog the pipes. Just think of the plumber's face. Despite yourself, you begin to relax. What is it, really? The gnome fidgets with his drink for a few seconds, then takes a mouthful and wipes his lips dry with the back of a grubby sleeve whose self-cleaning fabric he's long since overloaded. It's bread mix. What you mean is, what else is it? What? What else can it be? Keep thinking that thought. He smiles disquietingly. Probably nothing without secret ingredient X. He whistles between his teeth. Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Werner von Braun. Secret ingredient X? You read about so much stuff in the science blogs these days. The gnome holds up his pint. Zymergy, the oldest human science. Fermentation. Brewing. Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Brewer's yeast. It was one of the first organisms to have its genome sequenced. You know that. It's used in baking as well. It's what makes the bread rise. He picks up the packet. This bread mix is interesting. You could brew with it. The beer would probably taste like shit. It doesn't have any hops, but it'll still be beer. And with that, he slides it into one capacious coat pocket. You take another deep gulp from your pint glass. So, think of S. cerevisiae as a handy little biological factory. The gnome peers at the bag of bread mix. Normally, it'll produce bread, but suppose you want to send some interesting chemical feedstock to someone. All they need to know is that they chuck the bread mix in a sterile demijohn with 5 or 10 litres of warm water. And then it produces crap beer. Only before they put it in the demijohn, they add secret ingredient X, which is probably some dietary supplement you can buy over the counter in any health food shop. And in the presence of secret ingredient X, some extra metabolic pathway gets switched on, because this is not your ordinary S. cerevisiae. This is mutant ninja genetically engineered super yeast. But what does it make? The gnome finishes his pint and meets you with a bright-eyed smile. I really have no idea. And you know what? I don't particularly want to know. You don't want to know. Colonel Datka doesn't want you to know. Otherwise he'd have told you. It's a lot simpler if all anybody knows is that you've been told to hand out free samples of organic bread mix by your employer's trade delegation. Oh, and we didn't have this conversation, and we weren't in the back of a pub where there's sod all phone signal and no free net access and no CCTV because it's quarried out of the side of a granite cliff face. Are we singing from the same hymn book? After a moment, you nod. Is this what you were asking me to keep an eye out for? Could be. The gnome reaches into one pocket and pulls out a fat lump of dead cow skin, as battered and shapeless as if it has been whacked with a hammer. He opens it and pulls out a stack of banknotes. This is for you. Don't spend them all in the same place. You reach out and snatch the money. There's the thick end of 1,000 euros there, maybe more. Before the savage deflation of the past few years, you might have thought he was cheaping on you. But not now. It's enough to pay the mortgage arrears for 3 months. I don't know if I should be doing this. The gnome's grin slips. Neither do I, laddie. Neither do I. He puts the wallet away, then pats you on the knee. But just consider the alternatives. Toymaker. Headhunter. Ants. I'm surrounded by fucking ants. Can't they get anything right? This is not rocket science. Rocket science. Fucking 1930s shit invented by Nazi Übermensch engineers and so easy that by the 1990s even a bunch of camel fucking towel heads could master it. This is not AI. Artificial intelligence. Fucking 1950s shit invented by Jew boy intellectuals at Stanford and MIT and so useless that by the 1990s its highest achievement was beating a vodka-swilling Russian commie dogfucker at chess. This is not genetic engineering. Genetic engineering. Fucking 1970s shit invented by... You get the picture? This is logistics. It goes back to the fucking Stone Age. They can put a genetically engineered AI on Mars, but they can't shift a fucking suitcase between two hotels without losing it. I am surrounded by ants, and if this continues, I'm going to pull on my size 14 boots and go for a stomp. See if I don't. This isn't a complex job. Truly it isn't. I move hotels every day or two. In fact, I've been doing it every day or two for several years now. It's not as if my job's compatible with having a mortgage or living in a fucking suburban shoebox with an avocado bathroom suite and a bored housewife and nosy neighbors peering over the picket fence, is it? Santa's got a lot of traveling to do if all good children are going to get their toys. And the jet lag's a motherfucker. And so's my carbon footprint, but that's not my problem. The whiners'll figure out a way to fix global warming. Meanwhile, I fly business class. As I was saying, I travel a lot, and I travel light. 5.62 kilograms, to be precise. That's the maximum payload weight I allow myself to pack in my trolley case. That and the clothes on my back and the contents of my briefcase. If it goes over 5.62 kilos, I have to throw something out.
You can get a lot into 5.62 kilos. Shaver, suit, change of shirt and underwear, commercial samples, computers. Hotels have same-day cleaning stores that sell toiletries, and I'm on expenses, and if something starts getting shabby, I buy a replacement, and it goes in the trash. Capisce? My needs are simple. I need a hotel room and my luggage and a desk to sit at with a pad at the end of the day. And no, I'm not stupid. I don't keep anything important on my pad. It's all waiting in the cloud. I am in a very virtual line of work, almost ethereal. Anyway, this is what I'm paying you for. It inconveniences me mightily if I get to my new hotel room after a hard day's work and my rolling flight case with 5.62 kilograms of home is not there waiting for me. I need a change of underwear, and I need a shave, and I need my luggage. Only somebody has lost my shit. I hold you responsible. I see you nodding like a parcel shelf dog. No, don't look at me like that. This is about logistics, the necessary life support infrastructure for the modern commercial traveller. If you can't get your logistics right, you don't deserve to be in the hotel business, and I will personally make it my business to see that your corporate customer satisfaction officer learns that there is a day manager on the front desk at this hotel who is fucking off the customers. And it won't stop there. You will start to piss away corporate hospitality accounts like a junkie bleeding out into the urinal through his dick. Your staff will cross the road to avoid you, and you'll see vultures circling overhead because your days in the hospitality trade will be numbered. You'll lose your job, and the government will foreclose on your mortgage, and you'll be cast out onto the street to starve like an abandoned dog, or be eaten alive by feral mutant children who will skull-fuck your rotting corpse through the eye sockets with their huge gangrenous organs. This is all because you neglected to pay sufficient attention to your one most important customer today, namely, me. No, don't you fucking look at me like that, you cunt. If it's not me, then it could be anybody else who walks up to your desk today, this month, this year. It could be anybody, as long as they hate you with a fiery, all-consuming passion and decide to devote the next few months of their life to monstering you into an early grave for the sheer fun of pulling apart a quivering lump of feckless, time-expired meat. Get me my luggage, Mr. Hospitality Manager. It was due here 2 hours ago via inter-hotel transfer from the Marriott on Lothian Road. Here's the receipt. I'll be generous. You've got a couple of hours to save your job, your career, and your life. I'm going to go hunt down some dinner. Make sure my luggage is in my room and waiting for me when I get back, and we'll say no more about this matter. What line of work am I in, you ask? It's not really any of your fucking business. I sell toys. You're the acting toymaker in Edinburgh this month, here to take care of a nasty little headache for the operation, along the way to setting up a new subsidiary. Supply chain logistics and order fulfillment in the Central Belt, the Edinburgh-Glasgow M8 conurbation, where two-thirds of the population of the Gallus, Wee Free, Timeshare Republic huddle together below the Highlands, have taken a dive in the shitter of late. Unfulfilled demand remains high, but supply is patchy, and there is a risk of ad hoc competition emerging. Competition would be bad. The operation likes its subsidiaries to maintain a supply-side monopoly and goes to some lengths to keep it that way, even tolerating competition between local franchisee storefronts. It's a significant opportunity cost, but deterring interlopers from entering the market in the first place is cheaper than dislodging them once they're dug in. Scotland is a mess.
Word came down from the very top. Someone needs to go into the field and fix things. It's not just a matter of repairing the existing franchise, but of evaluating new market opportunities and, if necessary, taking the over-the-hill cash cow to the slaughterhouse, then bootstrapping a new cleanroom startup to replace it. Scotland is a small but significant market. As an entrepreneur, backed by the operation's training, guidance, and investor confidence, you can seize the opportunity to make your mark without pissing on the gateposts of any of the big incumbents. So you raise your virtual hand, volunteer for the job, and pull on the green wellies to wade out into the sticks and take control. Contrary to what you told the swithering fuckwad on the hotel front desk, it's not your habit to fly everywhere business class. In fact, you avoid flying wherever possible. You have gone to great lengths to maintain a clean identity, using all the tools the operation has made available to you. Airports are surveillance choke points, and the ubiquitous camera networks have AI behavioral monitors these days. Your unfortunate medical condition has certain side effects. Nobody say Voigt Kampf test, or you'll rip their fucking lungs out and shit down their windpipe. And if someone's told them to look for members of an organization that pursues an enlightened policy of positive discrimination with respect to people with certain neurological disabilities, you'd have nowhere to run. It's outrageous, blatant discrimination, but it seems there's one rule for the neurotypical and another for people like you. So you travel by train and ship. Freighter from Anchorage to Vladivostok, Trans-Siberian Express to Moscow, more tedious railway timetable shite until you arrived in the Schengen zone, then finally some blessed modernity. 2 fucking weeks, and all because you're a persecuted minority. The shiny new Shinkansen blasted through the English countryside at over 300 kilometers per hour, but you couldn't help noticing that not even Japan Rail could fix the English public service disease. You reflected on the issue at length. Perhaps if they made their train managers chop off a finger joint every time they were 5 minutes late or ran out of coffee in first class. But on reflection, you decided the health and safety busybodies would have a cow. And so you glared stonily at the refreshments manager before you went back to refactoring the structure of the regional business unit that the operation sent you to kill or cure. There are numerous obstacles to progress. Your predecessor in Scotland, the man who established the operation's subsidiary in that country, died unexpectedly 2 years ago, of high blood pressure, not low treachery. He was a knuckle-dragging gangster of the old school, a veteran of the underground wars that thrashed the Siloviki revenants out of the EU a decade ago. A street warrior, not a theoretician, in other words. And his business philosophy reflected his background. But he understood the basics. All the operation's subsidiaries and startups operate on the principle of making dreams come true. Recondite or frightening and illegal dreams, true. But dreams nonetheless. They require a marketing operation to bring the wares to the attention of the buying public, a fulfillment arm to get the goods to the punters, and a collection arm to pay for it all. So far, so good. Violence is a regrettable but necessary overhead on the balance sheets of the operation's startups. Like any enterprise that operates beyond the boundaries delineated by governments, with their self-proclaimed monopoly on the use of violence and their hypocritical attitude towards the legitimacy of certain markets, they must provide for their own defense. To the operations way of thinking, there is much to be said for the rule of fist and baseball bat. By keeping the beating as sublethal, costs are constrained, and the threat of escalation remains in reserve. Blood is a big expense, as the man said. Bodies are costly, Warfare is capital-intensive, and if you have to dig out the machine guns and start hiring soldiers, your profit margin is about to go into a power dive. Your predecessor, despite resembling a rabid silverback gorilla in both physical appearance and personal hygiene, understood this instinctively. He ran a tight ship and maintained credit control in a drastically hands-on manner. He had a rep for tittering unnervingly as he stroked his baseball bat and stared at his debtor's kneecaps. Almost everybody paid up on the spot. Nobody wanted to find out just what he was laughing at. Unfortunately, you lack the physical presence and instinctive sense of the theatrical to make this strategy work. Moreover, since the gorilla went to monkey heaven, the franchisees and street-level clients have become unduly frisky. Getting a handle on the major defaulters is proving tedious, although there are plenty of small fry to make an example of and opportunities for profit along the way. Thanks to the organization, you're in a position to outsource enforcement to contractors in the budget medical supplies business. But you don't want to waste your time playing hands-on godfather to a slumful of nitwitted glue sniffers. It's a lousy business model, with no scope for exponential scaling and monetization of the sweat equity you're going to have to inject to make any headway. The outputs from the gorilla's franchise scale linearly with the human inputs, because criminal retailing is labor-intensive. And while the gorilla was content to weed his patch in person, you have higher ambitions than a lifetime of stoop labor. The first thing they teach you in VC school is to pick a business model with scope for non-linear growth. Consequently, you have concluded that it would be far better to trash the gorilla's operation completely and establish a new one of your own design, leveraging best practice agile methodologies to maximize return on stakeholder investment in accordance with the operation's total startup commitment protocols, as your funding pitch puts it, than to try to nurse the emphysemic mafia holdover out of its intensive care bed and back into a wheelchair. So you drew up your plans and pitched them at the operation, talked through the cash flow and gained their grudging assent, and, more importantly, the first round of stakeholder equity to bootstrap the new business, on condition you keep the old cash cow pumping for the time being. And now you need to recruit an executive team for the startup. You're about to go gangster 2.0. One of the disadvantages of the virtual corporate lifestyle is that it keeps you too busy for the local health clubs and dojos. In response, you've developed a number of ad hoc workout substitutes. One of them is that you never catch a bus or a taxi if you can rent a bicycle or walk. Another, which also happens to be good ComSec practice, is never to contact clients via the networks if you can visit them in person without being observed. So when you walk out of the Hilton, your first stop is the Lothian bike railing outside. You always plan to turn up on a client's doorstep spick and span, unexpected as a hangman. To this end, you buy lightweight business suits that are impregnated with a magic nanotech fabric treatment that sheds sweat and body odors, not to mention dirt flung up from road surfaces. Before you start pedaling, you fire up a nifty and highly illegal applet that makes the jailbroken disposophone you're carrying emulate a cluster of zombie GPS transmitters. You tell it to send your rented bicycle's tiny mind on a random tour of the old town. It's all for the best if nobody can interrogate the bike about your movements later. Once you're on the bike lane, the lack of wireless access leaves you blind, but it's a welcome, familiar feeling, like having your own personal cloaking field.
It's a good palliative against the anxiety you feel for your missing luggage. The police indect networks might still be able to track you if they were watching right now, but the rich data they depend on is so bandwidth-intensive that it isn't routinely archived. In another 24 hours, there'll be no trace that you ever came this way. Before you set off, you downloaded a map and memorized a series of left-slash-right branches and waypoints. It's an archaic skill called orienteering, so you make good time despite the lack of nav aids. You review number one client's background yet again as you pedal along beneath the trees that line Dean Park Crescent. All the crescents here are tree-lined these days, legacy of a government scheme to roll back urban warming, giving your thighs as thorough a workout as any stationary cycling machine. Number one client has been of interest to the operation for some time. He has a number of technical aptitudes that have brought him to prominence in the employment database and to your personal attention as a candidate for headhunting. In particular, he's been of use in the past for organizing medium-scale redistribution of grey market FABA feedstock. He's proficient in highly scalable network-mediated marketing operations with high-yield outputs, and has a proven record of organizing wholesale supply chain ventures that include unmonitored cross-border trade, central multi-carrier dispatch of bespoke custom products, and VAT evasion. Which, all in all, is a pretty good match for what you're looking for in a chief operations officer. The gorilla didn't see any reason to employ someone with number one client's characteristics, but you've already established his operational shortcomings. The gorilla's idea of how to sell this particular product was straight out of the 19th century arts and crafts movement. Whereas number one client's business experience is a comfortably close approximation to the enterprise you intend to bootstrap, the only question remaining is number one client suitable management material, especially at the level you're planning to grow the business to? Number one client is not, alas, a flawless ruby in the dust. He has a criminal conviction and has served a stretch in prison. That on its own is sufficient to disqualify him from executive progression within the operation. But failure to obey the 11th commandment is no obstacle to a management post under suitable governance, and you need somebody with number one client's aptitudes and, equally importantly, local connections. A preliminary interview is indicated. And so you turn into an avenue of big stone houses and dismount at the curb beside number one client's townhouse, lock the bicycle, walk up to the front door, and, careful not to touch it with your bare skin, ring Michael Blair's doorbell.